Good morning. We're going to open the Human Services and Rural Health Policy Committee on this beautiful holiday, Monday morning, Martin Luther King's Day. Welcome. Glad you're all here. I was excited when I walked down the hall and heard voices. The first rule is if you have a cell phone, turn it on to the speaker mode so we can all hear the conversation.
Is that okay?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay, good. You know what to do with your cell phones, right? Okay.
I left mine in my office, Senator.
Jennifer will, our new committee staff person, will talk about the rules that we're going to adopt.
Should we open an organizational meeting?
We will open an organizational meeting. And Jennifer, if you would like to talk about the organizational committee rules.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the rules are standard throughout the Senate relative to committee rules. There's just one change from this session as opposed to last session, and that can be found in Section 18. And basically that no measure can be reported out of committee without a fiscal and revenue impact statement and all legislative council amendments attached and distributed and reviewed by the committee. So we just want to make special note that members are aware of that change.
Okay. That was at the insistence of our Senate president, who said, do not ask the president to rescind the Ways and Means referral, as we have in the past. He wanted to be sure of that. So things are getting kind of tight.
Mr. Chair, we can still do conceptual amendments. We just can't pass them out of committee until we've got that back from legislative council. We could, for example, do a conceptual amendment and have it written into whatever amendment we've got coming.
But it can't come out of
committee. But it's got to come back from LC in final form.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. Okay, do I have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the rules.
Discussion, objection, rules are adopted. I'd like to start with Senator Bridger and have her introduce herself. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Senator Joanne Bridger. I represent District 5, which is on the coast of Oregon. Beautiful Senate district from Coos Bay to Lincoln City. This is my second Senate term, and I'm very happy to be here and happy to be with your committee, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. I'm Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. Senator Bridger represents the second most beautiful part of the Oregon coast, and I represent the most beautiful part.
Oh.
So, and Douglas County and parts of Jackson and Josephine as well. I've been tag-teaming with Senator Morissette for a long time now, and I expect us to be able to still do some more good things this session, so I'm looking forward to the trip.
Thank you. Jennifer Keller. Jennifer, would you introduce yourself to the group, please?
My name is Jennifer Keller. I'm the committee administrator, and I'm pleased and happy to do whatever I can to accommodate the committee.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Chris.
I'm Senator Chris Telfer. I'm the newbie on the block, and as the freshman senator,
the real freshman senator.
And I represent District 27, which is the most beautiful part of the state, the middle of the state, the sunny part of the state, although I will say I ran home this weekend where we have 300 days of sunshine, and I left Salem with sunshine and arrived and spent the weekend in Bend with fog all weekend. So I'm glad to be back here. Looking forward to working with you all.
And she is particularly excited about 8 o'clock Monday morning meetings, as we all are. Senator Bill Moore said, I represent Senate District 6, which is my, I live in Springfield. We represent all of the Springfield district, with share that with Representative Beyer, and share the second part of the district with Representative Barnhart, which goes as far north as Lebanon, Sweet Home, Sodaville, that had a university at one time. I don't know if any of you are aware of that, Sotaville. Hmm. Yeah, it did. It had a college. Yeah, historic Four Corners is what it is now. That's about. Then I represent Coburg and Cresswell. So, with that, we will open our informational part of the meeting. And James, would you come up, please?
And Mary.
And Mary. Mary, of course. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Taves from the Department of Human Services, Senior People with Disabilities Division.
And I'm Mary Geer. I'm the Administrator for the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care, MDHS.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to make some real brief comments and then turn it over to Mary. Starting about 15 or 16 months ago, we made a whole series of presentations to this committee at the end of the last session and then throughout the interim, and we brought to your attention and everyone else's attention at that time the precipitous drop in Medicaid capacity in our community-based care system, particularly affecting assisted living, foster care, and residential care settings, and presented a paper at that time called A Crisis in Community-Based Care, where we had also seen an increase in nursing home usage as well with that decline on the community-based care side. And, of course, that was occurring at the same time that we were developing the long-range plan through a lot of instructions from this committee during the interim and from Senate Bill 1061 that was passed during the February supplemental session. And we all looked at the demographics and the fact that the aging population will more than double within the next 20 years. So to see a rapid decline in Medicaid capacity serving poor seniors and people with disabilities at the same time that the population demographic goes steadily up was of concern to all of us. And we worked very hard with you all in crafting a set of solutions and recommendations that Mary will go through in a minute that, to some degree, I think have been successful, or at least appear to be successful so far. There are still a lot of challenges that we face in the assisted living industry as well as the rest of our community-based care system for seniors and people with disabilities. The economic situation has posed major threats to some of our providers. You're all aware of one of our very large providers that is going through a very difficult financial period that serves nearly 3,500 seniors in the state of Oregon. We have other corporations providing assisted living that are still looking in at backing out of part of the Medicaid program and switching exclusively to private pay. We did a rate increase that this committee championed during the supplemental session to try to close the huge disparity between Medicaid rates and private pay rates so we didn't lose that part of the long-term care marketplace. And again, I think there's some stability that's been brought about as a result. But nonetheless, those threats are still very much out there and looming. And then combined now with the current budget crisis and the fact that we may well be forced to both cut Medicaid rates and numbers of people that are eligible could again create an additional crisis in our capacity, again, which is always troublesome because of the growing demographic over the next 20 years that will really create a doubling or a tripling of the need of for seniors and people with disabilities for all forms of care. So with that, Mary's going to sort of walk through the steps that we have taken and the results of that, and then we'll be willing to answer questions.
Good morning, Chair Morissette and members.
Good morning, Mary.
I'm going to just briefly go through the handout that we had for you. James talked about the background. We identified a number of factors that we believed were contributing to the decrease in Medicaid access.
Yeah. Mary, you need to identify yourself for the record, please.
Pardon me. I'm Mary Geer, Administrator of the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care. Thank you, Senator Cruz. So we identified a number of factors that contributed to the decrease in Medicaid access. One was the demographic, which meant there were more private pay people entering the marketplace, and so with and typically paying more than the Medicaid rate, and so providers were electing to serve a private pay market. We had a licensing moratorium that had been in place since 2001, which meant that there was a restriction on the new licenses that we were issuing. And then we saw more community-based care facilities that were entering gradual withdrawal contracts. And what that meant was that they would enter into a different Medicaid contract with us, which would allow them to continue to serve the people who had Medicaid who were currently in their buildings, but they would not take any more new Medicaid beneficiaries. So we saw the nursing facility utilization increase at the same time. So our strategy was to increase the awareness of this issue, as James discussed, and then the $260 rate increase that was approved by the special session in February. In addition, the February legislative session passed Senate Bill 1061, which directed the department to do a number of things to address this issue. One was to develop an acuity-based rate methodology, and we've had a number of stakeholder work groups to come up with some draft recommendations. We are continuing to meet with stakeholders, and we'll probably have one more stakeholder meeting before we finalize those recommendations to bring to this legislative session. We're looking at our Medicaid contracts to see if there is a way that we can provide incentives to providers with our contracting process. Senate Bill 1061 also looked at the moratorium and repealed that as of December 31st. So there's a new rule in place to assist with criteria for looking at licensing applications that we get. And then also asked us to assess and monitor the ongoing community-based care capacity, which I'll talk about in a minute. We have dedicated staff to developing new providers in community-based care. We are in the process of doing a needs assessment of what's needed around the state, especially for specialty providers. And by specialty providers, I mean providers who can serve folks who have particular needs or high needs, such as people who have behavioral needs that might not be addressed in a usual setting, folks who have dementia, those kinds of things. So the last page of the handout is the numbers. Senate Bill 1061 directed us to benchmark our community-based care access as of January 1, 2008. So in the chart, the top number is the January 1 benchmark number. The one underneath it is our access numbers as of September 30th of 08, which is the last full quarter that we have data for. And as you'll see, things have leveled out. There's a few areas where we've gained some access, but by and large, I think the good news is that we've stopped losing access in most areas. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Getting back to the repeal of the moratorium, was there significant changes made in the certificate of need process at that point, or is it pretty much still the same process we had before the moratorium?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, the certificate of need does not apply to community-based care. It only applies to nursing homes.
Right.
So that remains the same.
And
what we did, however, is develop a new rule, as Mary mentioned, for new facilities potentially coming online at the end of the moratorium, that based on the legislation from the supplemental session actually has us requiring that programs will demonstrate their interest potentially in serving low-income populations or Medicaid populations. So that's part of the new rule and criteria, along with the regulatory history of an agency, et cetera. So that was all implemented to at the end of the moratorium. However, I mean, for obvious reasons, we haven't had a lot of new programs or new construction since that time, given the rest of the economic situation.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I knew what certificate needed applied to, but it made it sound like you were putting in place new criteria for licensing. So, and it sounds like you are using a carrot here. So, okay.
Yes, Senator Bridger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mary, I would appreciate it if you would expand a little bit on the new provider development. Where did you go with that? Who has it been successful, and if successful, how many?
Senator Chair Morissette and Senator Verger, we have one staff person who's been dedicated to development, and then development has always been the part of a part of the job of many staff in SPD. The person who's been dedicated to development has primarily focused on adult foster homes around the state. Those are the smaller home settings. Mm-hmm. And in terms of numbers, I'm sorry I don't have that, but I can get that for you in terms of the development. What she's done is she's gone around the state and visited local offices and talked also to advocacy organizations about what are the unmet needs in your community, and really tried to recruit new providers. For example, one of her strategies was to attend a job fair at the Eastern Oregon Training Center. That's a center that's been downsizing. There are staff there that are looking for other opportunities, and so there were nurses and direct caregivers there who were very interested in an adult foster home as an alternative. She's attended job fairs in other parts of the state and has found a number of folks who are interested in this as a business opportunity.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just going back to the kind of background a little bit on the crisis in Lincoln County, you remember, where we had people displaced. And so I just wonder if I could get a better feel for where we are today. In other words, the providers that really didn't want to take anyone except people that were able to pay. Mm-hmm. And that was a terrible burden on people at a time when gasoline prices were $4 a gallon and they were trying to put family members over in the valley, and they had jobs and couldn't travel. So to me, that was just a crisis situation. And I just wonder how many of those people were displaced. Did they go into foster homes? What happened to them?
Chair Morissette and Senator Verger, the closure or termination of the Medicaid contract of the facility in Lincoln County, Spencer House, resulted in the relocation of about 18 clients, as I understand it. And they went to a variety of settings. Some of them went to different parts of the state. Some of them went to another assisted living that was in the same county, Hillside, and others went to foster homes in the same county. So we went through our usual relocation process in looking at those clients, which was to talk with each of them about where it is that they wanted to be, beginning with what their needs were, what their wishes were, and then looking to accommodate that as closely as possible with what was available. And you're absolutely right. There were some people who were relocated out of county, and that was a difficulty for family members who needed to travel. The corporation that terminated that Medicaid contract at the same time also entered into a gradual withdrawal contract at the rest of their other 17 assisted
right.
living facilities. And this is a corporation that has very clearly said its business model nationally is to not serve Medicaid beneficiaries.
One last comment,
yes.
Mr. Chair. I guess that being in a budget crisis the way we are, there are several things that concern me because people with disabilities and some of our seniors not looking too bright in the budget as it is recommended. And so I guess what I think maybe we haven't done a good job with is showing people that the people we serve actually need the service. In other words, there is the criticism or pushback that we don't need to serve people if they're able to take care of themselves. And so that's just, I want to share that with you this morning because that's a little thread that I hear on the budget situation, and I think that we need to do a better job in showing that the people that we serve are people that absolutely need us, and that we're not just serving people that come and are using the government. Thank you.
Okay. How many new facilities have come online during the moratorium that were grandfathered in? Because there are several in my community, and I'm just wondering if there, why we... Okay, we lifted the moratorium, meaning more people can, you know, more can apply, but... Mm-hmm. So, do you have a number?
Chair Morissette, it's approximately 85 to 90 facilities that were licensed between 2001 and the end of the moratorium. Okay. Some of those were grandfathered.
Yeah.
Some of them were new applications that we... where we made an exception to the licensing moratorium. There were very clear criteria in the rule that allowed us to make an exception for providers that would serve a Medicaid population or a low-income population or where they could show exceptional need.
So what do you anticipate happening now that we've lifted the moratorium? Are we... during these difficult times?
Chair Morissette, this isn't exactly a time for a lot of new development in community-based care. So given the economic situation, I think it will perhaps be some time before we see a real increase. And as James mentioned, we did put criteria in place to look at the need in a community as well as what populations would be served. Recall that the moratorium was put in place because of the building boom of the 90s, and really where we had more capacity than we really needed. So this is a way to try to get a little bit of balance with that.
We're probably very, very fortunate that we did that because there might have been, you know, excessive building as there were, as happened in other parts of the country. You mentioned the problem with one of the large companies that grew very, very rapidly. I have one facility in my city. And my question has to do, though, with the big picture, have we lost any facilities in the last... But we've had new ones open, but have we lost any of the existing ones?
Mr. Chairman, the shorter answer is no. We have not yet lost any facilities in Oregon, although a few facilities in other states of this particular corporation have closed down. But I would say we have worked incredibly hard with this particular corporation. Through filings and foreclosures and bankruptcy, we've been in almost constant communication and trying to assure that every facility and everyone being served in those facilities will still remain in place. Parts of the program in Oregon are in the process of being sold, and we're hopeful with new owners that, and we've talked to them, we've talked to the management companies that will probably operate those facilities. We have every expectation at this point that they will stay open. So that continues to be our hope. It's been a very complicated case, obviously, with lots of different players and investors and lenders, and but our primary goal from the beginning has been the residents and the safety and the of the residents. So at this point, we don't anticipate closures, but again, it's a very tenuous situation, so I wouldn't absolutely guarantee that we would not lose capacity, but it's our hope still that that will not occur.
In one of the conversations that I had with you, we discussed requirements, pre-existing requirements in different facilities, and you indicated that you have a much more rigid oversight of the nursing homes than you do of assisted living and residential care and so on. Could you explain that?
I'll punt that to Mary.
Chair Morissette. I guess where I would start first in comparison is nursing facilities are primarily regulated by federal law. There is some state rule, and the federal law...
Excuse me just a minute. Now, we are also... Clarify this for the record. What obligation do we have to place people in a nursing home? What are our obligations if they meet the standards?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the nursing homes is a mandatory program under Medicaid, under federal law. Any state that takes a single dollar of Medicaid has to provide that mandatory benefit. So anybody who is eligible for nursing home care can elect to enter a nursing home and to stay there. Obviously, most people don't want to do that if they can live at home with our in-home program or in other community-based facilities. And, of course, Oregon is still on top of most states in terms of offering capacity on the community side. And Oregon has also attempted to keep a somewhat liberal definition of nursing home eligibility, because that same eligibility stretches to your, under federal law, to your home and community-based program as well. So if you're using Medicaid in the community, it has to absolutely match your institutional level of care on the nursing home side. So we make the argument, as many states do, that even an individual who gets 10 hours of in-home care a month and maybe needs some help with shopping and mobility and home chores, et cetera, would otherwise qualify and could elect, if they so chose, to go into a nursing home. And that's why the hydraulics of managing long-term care become so difficult. If you begin to lose community capacity, those individuals automatically are eligible for nursing home care, would obviously have to go there if there were no other alternatives, and of course at twice or three times the cost. So it is a mandatory benefit that we cannot deny.
Okay, thank you. Now, in the event that we lose capacity in other facilities because we make cuts in our Medicaid match, if we then people will go into a nursing home, and what's the ballpark difference between the cost of the different facilities?
Mr. Chairman, foster care usually ranges between about $1,200 and $1,600. Assisted living, I think, ranges from $16 to a little over $2,000. Nursing home care now, I think, is about, with the last rate, close to $6,000 a month. So, in most cases, two to three times the cost.
And we don't have a choice.
Mr. Chairman, no, we cannot deny eligibility.
Okay. So in these difficult times, if we lose capacity, if we don't serve people adequately, for instance, Oregon Project Independence, which is not a Medicaid program, but if a person who is on Oregon Project Independence decided, if they're cut off, that they were going to go to a nursing home, we would have to pay the bill.
Mr. Chairman, in regard to Oregon Project Independence, for the most part, those people are pre-Medicaid, so they're not yet
Medicaid eligible. I see. Okay. So we won't talk about Project Independence, but what about in-home care?
But, for example, Mr. Chairman, in the governor's recommended budget, we reduce hours or we cut people under about 80 hours a month, which would affect close to 6,500 individuals. Who, yes, under the current Medicaid program, if they cannot survive at home with that reduction in their in-home hours, yes, they could elect to go to a nursing home, although we have another alternative in the governor's budget that would actually lower the income standard, which would cut across the board. That would affect even people in nursing homes or community-based care or living at home, who, if they no longer met that income threshold, would also not be eligible. And they could not automatically go into nursing homes under that recommendation.
They could not.
They could not. They would no longer be Medicaid eligible unless they had the capacity to pay privately, but most of them would not have that capacity.
That's interesting. Okay, so we are cutting the income eligibility from down to 13.
Mr. Chairman, that's one of the recommendations in the governor's recommended budget, is to reduce the monthly income requirement from about $1,900 a month to $1,300 a month, correct?
And then they're not eligible then.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. Any other?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. How much flexibility does Medicaid give the states on determining income level?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz...
I mean, would that be a waiver request, or...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, not much. What we did to get to the pretty deep budget reduction targets, because of what Senator Morissette has been pointing out, that if you just keep cutting community-based care and people are still eligible for nursing home care, then your costs don't go down. They actually accelerate very quickly. So one of the proposals that's on the table is to replace our home and community-based waiver with a different option that was authorized by Congress in the Deficit Reduction Act. It's called a state plan option, and called the I-plan, to use a bureaucratic term. And that income eligibility is different than the usual Medicaid eligibility for income that most states use. It's 150% of poverty, which equates to the $1,300 versus the $1,900 that we use now. We're out on a limb on this proposal. It's not been made in any other state except for expanding services to the mental health population. In this case, it's on the table as a potential reduction option. So whether the federal government would approve it, whether we could implement it, remains to be seen. And the difficulty there is that an income standard is so arbitrary. It pays no respect to a person's level of care or their needs. So in this case, I think in that proposal, we'd even remove 1,300 people from nursing homes, 700 or 800 of which are almost total care residents. So it begs huge questions about how you apply income criteria across the board. And we simply don't know what the federal government is going to do or approve. And obviously they have lots of different states that are in the same situation as Oregon. So we expect all kinds of strange proposals to be going to the Centers on Medicaid and Medicare. And what the response will be, we don't know. And, of course, all that will be tempered one way or another by the size of the stimulus package, which hopefully will have a large Medicaid match rate increase that hopefully will offset some of these reductions.
Yes.
A couple things. Number one, I think based on what Schwarzenegger's saying and who the Speaker of the House is, I think the whole stimulus package is going to California. But I guess, is there any way we can have a sense of where CMS is going to come down in time to have an impact on our decision here? Because historically CMS is not really quick in their decision process. So, we could be putting ourselves out on a limb and have it chopped off behind us is one of the things I'm looking at here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, I think we'll know pretty quickly what the size of the stimulus package and its specific effect on the Medicaid program is going to be, so that will help shape our decisions whether that's going to offset the continuing revenue decline in Oregon. We just don't know, but we'll know that fairly soon. Whether they would then approve a subsequent change from a waiver to a state plan with different income eligibility is questionable, and at least what we've seen in the language so far in the House version of the stimulus package, states would be required to maintain the same eligibility in order to take the enhanced federal match. So that would probably mean that the state plan option that is on the table in the governor's budget now may well not be accepted by Medicaid if we try to file such a plan option. There's so much uncertainty at this point.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's fairly standard. You know, if you're going to do an expansion and you're going to go to a different standard, that's sometimes acceptable, to lower something for our current population, CMS, I just can't imagine them looking favorably upon that. So
how many federal dollars do we leave on the table currently?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure. Are you talking about the governor's recommended budget?
Well, okay. If we put additional money into the Medicaid match, could we draw more Medicaid dollars from the feds?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely.
Yeah, well, how much? I mean, what's the big deal about them giving us more Medicaid money if we can't get the stuff that we already have access to? Unless they lower our requirement for the match. Are they going to lower our requirement for the match? Is that what they're talking about?
Mr. Chairman, no, but they simply increase the match. So for the same amount of state general fund you put in, you actually get a bump.
So what are
the usual match rate?
Where do you think we're going to get the money in the governor's budget or any, you know, we're competing with schools, we're competing with prisons, we're competing with all kinds of other worthy programs, and yet we are not able to draw down, federal dollars that we could use right now, and for them to give us a better deal. That's like, saying, come in and buy our stuff for 70% off. Well, a lot of people don't have the money to buy this good stuff for 70% off. So I don't know. There's no talk of block grants to states for health care.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think, and actually, it's interesting in the whole presidential campaign and leading up to the new administration, there's been very little discussion about long-term care. It's all been focused on the healthcare side. I think that's going to start changing in the next couple of years, given the demographic. For every 40 cents we put in, obviously the federal government gives us 60 cents in the Medicaid program. The strategic increase in rates that you all authorized in the February special session, $260 a month per person in community-based care, that was the state general fund side. We matched all of that with a sizable increase in the federal match. So where we get the state general fund dollars still to maintain the Medicaid program and match the federal funds is going to be the issue for this legislative session, obviously.
Did the governor recommend cuts in the programs that we have to fund in order to maintenance of effort programs? Are we okay on those maintenance of effort programs so far? Or have there been cuts in them? Or will there be recommended cuts?
Or are there? Mr. Chairman, in the governor's recommended budget, again, from the continuing service level for the senior and disability program, I think our continuing service level was about $3.5 billion in the governor's recommended budget. It's a little over $2.9 million. That equates to about $232 million in general fund reductions, and then the balance is the federal match. In one of the proposals, of the $232 million in general fund reductions, about $100 million of that is the actual change in the income eligibility. That's the portion we believe, looking at the fine print so far of what are still proposals in Congress, that we probably could not implement if we were going to take the federal stimulus money.
Now, the increase in the federal match is 67% instead of 60%, or what is it?
What's the latest version in the House?
62, and figure you got 5% on top of that, so take it to 67
for
the unemployment piece.
Right. For how many quarters now is it? But
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 2 years? I thought it was three. It's two?
I think it's two, correct.
Now, what, and I hate to keep after you on this, but what additional cuts may be made before the end of this biennium? Are there some, will the government across the board require additional cuts of existing programs before we get to the end of this biennium?
Mr. Chairman, you're probably above my pay grade at this point in terms of across the board, but obviously the news from last week on the additional deficit for this biennium is going to be a real struggle. Part of our problem, since we have so little of the biennium left to make reductions, and in most of our programs, when you look at the cuts for next biennium, for example, some are 18 months into the biennium, some are less, but we always, when you change the Medicaid program or you change eligibility, people have appeal rights, you have notice requirements. So it takes us a series of months even to implement a reduction, which means we could be heading into March, April, or May before you could even begin to start those reductions. So the compression time and what's left in the biennium then sends the reductions even much deeper. So I cannot begin to answer how we'll implement that for the duration of this biennium.
Well, let me ask a question in a different way. Do you have a figure, ballpark figure, that DHS in general will, and SPD in particular, might have to think about cutting this biennium? Has that come down from the governor's office?
Mr. Chairman, no, it is okay. Not at this point.
Okay. Yes. Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair. James, I've seen the numbers, the proposed numbers from on the stimulus package from the House. Have you seen or are you familiar with any numbers from the Senate? Because I haven't seen anything there. I mean, is their FMAP number similar or do we even know at this point?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, I mean, we actually saw a proposal some months ago on the Senate side. That's probably long been put back on the shelf, and I think at one point the figure of 8% was floating around, but I think at this point the House version is the one that's getting airtime, and I have not seen a Senate response. Jim or some others might have more updated information on that, but we have not.
I mean, I'm assuming the Senate and the House don't usually necessarily agree on these things, and I think it's quite clear that President-elect Obama is not going to see the stimulus package on his desk tomorrow, so which is what he wanted. So I'm just wondering if there even seems to be a sense of urgency on the Senate side back there to do something, because what Schwarzenegger said, that if California didn't get $70 billion in 2 weeks, they were going to go out of business. So obviously there's some certainty for some folks here. So.
Okay.
You don't need to comment on that. That was just editorial.
I probably won't.
I interrupted Mary's discussion of, I guess, regulations for... Well, the question is, we have the assisted living, the residential care, the adult foster homes, and then we have the nursing homes, which are federally required and so on, different standards. What kinds of regulations, oversight, do we require of in licensing for the other facilities, the community-based facilities?
Chair Morissette, licensing and regulation of assisted living, residential care, Alzheimer's care units, and adult foster homes are in rule. The licensure period for those is a little bit different. For nursing facilities, we license them for a year and do annual inspections. We also do annual licenses and reviews in adult foster homes. Our other community-based care settings are licensed for a two-year period, and we do a licensing review every 2 years.
What kind of a review do you do every 2 years? A financial?
Chair Morissette, the review or inspection or survey that we do is focused on quality of care and quality of services.
Okay.
So the people who go in to do these licensing reviews are nurses, social workers, dietitians, and they're looking at the services that are provided, and they're interviewing residents to see that their needs are being met.
Okay. Now, we're not talking about ombuds persons. We're talking about others who go in and do the review.
Chair Morissette, that's exactly right.
Could you talk a little bit more about who these people are, what category, and so on?
Chair Morissette, certainly. We have two classifications, if you will, of folks who go in and do inspections. One is adult protective services workers.
Mm-hmm.
These are the workers at the local level who are especially trained to investigate abuse and neglect in community settings as well as facility settings. And they'll go into our community-based care settings when there's an allegation of abuse or neglect against an individual. We also have our client care monitoring units in three offices around the state. And those are federally certified surveyors who are trained to do nursing facility inspections, and we also use that skill base to do our inspections in assisted living and residential care facilities.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Follow-up
thing?
Senator Morissette. Senator Morissette mentioned the financial. Do you ever look at the charges that they charge their private pay in particular, especially when there's a mixed Medicaid population?
Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Anderson, in terms of any financial review that we do for community-based care, we request at the time of initial licensing, we request a market study and do a credit check and criminal background check, and that's really the only time that we look at any financial information about a facility. So initial licensure or when there's a change of ownership, so a new person or a new entity is getting licensed. Otherwise, we don't do any kind of a financial review or regular financial review in facilities. We also do not regulate the rates at all on the private pay side.
Follow up there. And maybe there's nothing that we can do, but I know that there are a number of families who are paying private pay because paying close to, well, like my father, almost $6,000 a month toward the end of his life, which it is based on service units that are that he needed, and it kept going up, but it was amazing. And if I'd go in and I'd question every single one, and I know that there could be abuse, and especially when you have the family pain, many families just aren't quite as aware of all of that, and they will just pay. So I'm hoping that most caregivers, I think mine was very good, but there could be quite a bit, I think, of abuse, and we have no monitoring system of that. I find that questionable.
Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Anderson, if I can just make sure I understand, you're suggesting the abuse would be excessive fees, for example, for services that are provided.
Plugging in, a service unit here and a service unit there, because when you have this 3 or 4 page form in front of you saying, well, this is how his care has, I caught a couple of errors, nothing serious, it was just an oversight, but I think that this maybe, it could be more common, and I'm just wondering if that could be part of the review process, just auditing one or two cases.
Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Anderson, that certainly is part of our process on the Medicaid side, to ensure that people who are receiving services that Medicaid is paying for are actually receiving those services, and if you will, that we're getting what we pay for. That's the whole Medicaid auditing process. There is not a similar process for private pay beneficiaries, and as you indicate, that's really left to the family or whoever might be representing that individual.
Was your father in a... Was it a nursing home or a community?
Assisted living.
Assisted living.
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Chairman and Senator Mona Sanderson, I don't think under current law we have the authority to regulate or monitor private pay. I mean, obviously, we're concerned about private pay because in many cases, if the rates are excessive, then a person spends down, becomes Medicaid eligible. So that's something that is of keen interest to us. But part of the reason we also wanted to close the gap partially between Medicaid and private pay is some pretty strong evidence that private pay in some cases was actually subsidizing Medicaid because Medicaid was too low. I mean, it's almost like health care where the insured are paying for the uninsured. So getting a closer balance, I think, would help temper the otherwise spikes in private pay. But under current law, that's not authority we have.
Okay. Good. Other questions, and we'll move on to the next. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
We may bring you back up, so don't go too far.
If there are complaints regarding actual abuse towards on the financial end, and they would report it to you, then this is for a private pay. Would you follow up or not in the licensing process? I mean,
Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Sanderson, if there were complaints about services received in a facility, depending on what that looked like, yes, we would investigate. If it were abuse or neglect, it would be investigated by Adult Protective Services
yes.
in between licensure visits. And then at a licensure visit, that certainly is something that we could look at as a part of the license, which covers private pay and Medicaid. It also would probably be a situation where we would suggest that the family or the person who is concerned talk with an ombudsman who maybe could go through the bill with them, help them negotiate or have a conversation with the facility if that was not going very well, something that the ombudsman does really well.
Thank you.
Meredith, you're up. We're speaking ombudsman right now, so would you come up, please? Thank you very much.
Were you listening to what she said? She said, talk to Meredith. Introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Meredith Cote, and I'm the long-term care ombudsman for the state of Oregon. For those of you that may be new to this panel, what the ombudsman does is that we identify, investigate, and work to resolve complaints that are made by or on behalf of the residents of long-term care facilities. We're informal problem solvers. We're not a regulatory agency. We try to work through problems within the four walls of the facility. We also serve as an advocate for residents, and the way that we accomplish our work is that we recruit, train, and certify volunteers to be a regular presence in long-term care facilities. Currently, we have about just about 140 certified ombudsman volunteers, and today I was asked to speak about, in general terms, about quality of care and assisted living. And currently we have volunteers regularly visiting 114 of the 205 assisted living facilities throughout the state, so at about 56%. So although we respond to complaints in all long-term care facilities, the distinction is that in 56% of them, we have a volunteer who regularly visits the facility in order to meet with the residents, to earn their trust, and to work with them to resolve issues and problems that emerge. We also refer allegations of abuse and neglect to local protective services offices for investigation, and Mary referenced that earlier. In looking at quality of care analysis, it occurred to me that there are three different data sets that one might look at to see what kinds of issues and problems are emerging. One is complaint data from our office, and we actually collect data through a system called the National Ombudsman Reporting System, which is NORS, and it's administered by the Federal Administration on Aging. And we actually collect complaint information, complaint data from all our program representatives along 132 different complaint categories. And another set of information that one might look at is deficiencies or citations. Mary talked about when they go in every 2 to 3 years and inspect assisted living facilities and residential care facilities. Well, pursuant to those licensing inspections, they may look at a facility's practice and say that it is deficient in some area and identify those. So that information, the deficiencies that are identified by the client care monitoring units pursuant to their inspection reports, is another data set that one might look to to get some idea of what the issues are. And of course, the other data set would be to look at a compilation of the substantiated abuse complaints that are emanating from that type of facility around the state. For purposes of today, I was going to talk to you briefly about ombudsman data and then refer a little bit to some of the client care monitoring citation data, which I had asked of Mary last week after I got the invitation to come here today. I wanted to look a little at some of their citation data, so I'll just talk a little bit about that. But right now, our office is compiling the information for the federal reporting year that started in October 1 of 2007 and ended September 30th, 2008. And we will be filing a report with the Administration on Aging at the end of the month with all of the information from that time period, all of the complaint information of our program. And with respect to ELS, preliminarily, we closed that is, we saw from two resolution about 1,100 complaints.
Excuse me, you're using an acronym that everyone may not be familiar with, ELS.
ELS. I apologize for that. Assisted Living Facilities.
Not the TV show.
not the little people.
Our preliminary, ELS. Yes, I can see how it could be easily mistaken. But preliminarily, we closed out, that is, sought a resolution about 1,100 complaints in assisted living facilities in the reporting federal reporting year 2008 that I just described. We verified about 73% of those, about 800 complaints. We also have at least 200 to 300 other complaints in assisted living which we have worked on during that period that we have not yet closed, and they will remain open and we will continue to work on those complaints. The number one, and historically it's been the number one complaint that we have worked on in assisted living in our program, is food service. Quantity, quality, variation, and choice. And, you know, it's really interesting. People always want to dismiss food complaints because they say, well, you can't please, the often refrain that we hear from administrators is you can't please everybody. But the truth of the matter is that in these facilities, when people have given up a lot in their lives, they've given a lot of their friends, their possessions, their independence to come into a facility, food remains something that's very important to them. And quite frankly, what we have found that in many of these facilities, food service is given short shrift. It is not given the attention it needs commensurate with the desires of the residents and the need for good quality food and good choices around their food. So that is, year in and year out, that is among the top three complaint issues that the Ombudsman Program responds to. The other issue that's a very big one for us is discharges and evictions. In facilities, there are occasions when residents are asked to leave, and they're asked to leave against their will. And under the rules and regulations, they have protections. This is their home, and so the facility can only ask them to leave under certain circumstances that are articulated in the rules. And so we find that frequently when residents are in the position where they're asked to leave, they call upon our agency to be their advocate through the process with the facility. We usually stop being their representative at the point where it might go to administrative hearing, in which case it's always best that they have legal representation. So we handle a lot of those complaints in assisted living and other community-based care settings.
I want to go back to the food part. I notice in the Register Guard paper in Lane County that your office or volunteer spent 80 hours in one of our facilities. That was part of the a trouble facility.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one of the interesting things that happened starting last year is that we've been involved with the bankruptcy court and the U.S. Trustee's Office. The 2005 Bankruptcy Consumer Protection Act provided that for when health facilities go into a bankruptcy, I think it's anything other than a Chapter 13 bankruptcy, there must be a patient care ombudsman appointed by the court unless there's a showing that there's not a need for such an entity. And so we have been called upon in 2008, starting with three different adult foster care homes that went into Chapter 7 bankruptcies. And then, of course, without naming the chain, James and Mary talked about a very prominent chain in Oregon that has had several bankruptcies. And we have been called upon in the facility that Mr. Chair discussed to actually, we were appointed by the Tennessee Bankruptcy Court to be the patient care ombudsman to oversee the quality of the care in that facility during the course of the bankruptcy. So what that requires of our agency is rather some intensive monitoring of the facility and then reports to the bankruptcy court at 60-day intervals. And so one of the requirements of the law is that we do patient interviews. And so in the facility that Mr. Chair referenced, there were over 80 residents. And so what we did in the beginning is to sit down with every one of those residents to see what kinds of issues, what kinds of concerns they had relative to their stay at that particular facility. So that's why it required that kind of intensity of effort. And in facilities that we normally go into, the volunteers will spend 2 hours a week in a facility. But we were doing something a little bit different, are currently doing something a little different in that particular facility. And one of the struggles we've had as an agency is that the U.S. Trustee's Office here in Oregon is very reluctant not to have a patient care ombudsman in a facility that's going through bankruptcy. And, of course, for our agency, it's a resource issue, and so we've been working with the Department of Human Services to try to prioritize the facilities where we would perform that function. So
one of the complications, and in talking with the industry, I am learning some very valuable information. Many of the facilities are privately owned in the state of Oregon. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that is in fact
true.
Yeah,
okay. This particular facility was part of a large chain, and one of the complaints that people had is that they were private pay and the money was leaving the facility, going to pay off other debt and so on, which I can understand that to be a very large concern. But as an industry as a whole, okay, let me kind of take another viewpoint. Any bankruptcy, regardless of whether or not it's an individual facility going bankrupt, they might have the same kinds of concerns. If it's a chain going bankrupt, that facility may be very viable with its patient base, may be very viable because they're private pay and it's a very nice, that particular facility is a very nice facility. And so their concern was the money was going into a different pot to pay off other debt, and we have no control over that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, those are matters that I know that have come up in the court, and generally speaking, there are some of the facilities, as I understand it, within that chain that were generating revenue and were self-sustaining, mm-hmm. and there are others where that was more problematic, and what they were doing with the money and how they were moving that money around, I think, was something that the courts are is being discussed in that legal setting, and it's not something that we've been particularly involved in. But the interesting thing is about, you know, a Chapter 11 bankruptcy is about reorganization. And the hope is with those bankruptcies that things will come out better at the other end. And there are lots of circumstances that are generating the bankruptcies in one building or another. But I think that that's one of the things that the residents in the facilities, there's bankruptcy always conjures up a certain anxiety because people think about bankruptcy as something, a liquidation, where in fact a Chapter 11 is a reorganization bankruptcy. And again, so one of the roles is to try to work with the residents to sort of clarify things. We got lots of people calling us, asking questions about being nervous. You know, am I going to lose my home? Is this facility going to close? And part of that is trying to assuage those concerns, being realistic, but trying to assuage those concerns so that people aren't unduly anxious about their circumstances in the facility. So,
getting back to Senator Mona Sanderson's question and concern, your ombudsperson's would help her or any concerned individual about the itemized list of charges and whether or not they were excessive and so on.
Mr. Chair, I was smiling when the Senator Mona Sanderson was describing that issue because it is among the top 10 issues and complaints that we work on in the Ombudsman Program. And in fact, in this reporting period, it was sort of the number 4 most frequent. And it's all around billings and charges and questionable charges and being billed for services they're not receiving or they believe they're not receiving. And there is a fair amount of concern about that. And in fact, some of the local senior service agencies refer those issues to us. And we usually work to get those resolved. Some of them we can resolve rather quickly for people. Others are difficult. Some of the corporate chains make their bills very, very difficult to understand. And so people do not even know what they're paying for. And we have had some facilities, particularly some of the larger corporations that have, particularly when there's been an out-of-state office, and so the facility administrator refers you to the corporate office. The corporate office then doesn't return your phone calls. And so we're the ones that get on the phone and start dogging the corporate office to try to get resolution. Sometimes, but these are all over the map. Sometimes there's a procedure precipitous increase. Say a family doesn't attend a what's called a service planning conference where on a quarterly basis you and I see the senator nodding, but on a quarterly basis where you sit down and you assess what the services that the resident needs and what kind of additional services they may or may not need. And if there's a decision, there can be a decision made that the person needs more services at that time. And if there's nobody, and the facility is obliged to give written notice at the point that it determines that more services are needed, but there are times when people get family members who haven't participated in that process will get a bill and they don't understand or why their rate is increased. So yes, we handle a lot of those. We resolve a lot of those successfully for people, but it is a very big issue and around billing. And I guess if it would be one thing that I would require in terms of a regulatory requirement, would be that bills be readily understandable.
Thank you. I was just going to suggest that we
and that they not be written in ways that tend to obfuscate. And sometimes, you know, people have their own unique accounting systems, and it may seem very, very clear to some accountant somewhere, but to a consumer, it is like a foreign language. So that is, and you know, one of the things that our agency pressed for in the last revision of residents' rights was that the people have, you know, a right to information, this kind of information, when they ask about it, because it was surprising to us how many people asked for clarification around billing, and they didn't, and they would get nothing. And in fact, there was one chain that actually, if a consumer who didn't understand their bill could not get information about their bill, and so as a protest, they did not pay it pending just getting some more information, they would get a penalty attached to their bill for not paying the bill in a timely manner. So there's lots of issues around.
Well, I see that Mary Geer and Jim Carlson are both taking notes.
No. but so billing was the fourth. And before billing, in terms of the frequency of the complaints that we've dealt with, another area is medication administration. That can be a very complex area. It is challenging for community-based care facilities. It is challenging even for nursing homes. And we address a lot of complaints relative to medications, you know, whether basic kinds of issues around the right medication at the right time, the right dose. There are lots of very legitimate concerns about medications. There's lots of medication mix-ups in these facilities, and then there are occasions when residents have a perception that their medication schedule should be X. The facility has a perception that they have a bigger latitude than X, and so there needs to be some communication between the parties to ensure that everybody is satisfied relative to medication regimens.
A person goes into an assisted living facility, whether or not they have their own physician, they must have their own physician somewhere.
They should have their own physician.
And their own physician should make sure, I hope, that our doctor wants to see the pill bottles to make sure, not just see the bottle, see the strength of the pill and so on, and he's very concerned about taking over-the-counter medication that might interfere or, you know, with a prescription, and that is huge. So I don't know how you deal with that. And, you know, I'm hoping that people do have their own doctors, and I hope their own doctors are the ones who monitor that. Who else would monitor it?
Physicians have an interesting relationship to the long-term care system, and some people are fortunate enough to find physicians who want to be partners with them throughout their their life in a long-term yeah. care facility. Other times, physicians are more difficult to access, and so there's a lot. I guess what I would say is there's a lot of variation in terms of the physician's involvement. But the bottom line is the physician is issuing the orders, and the facility is supposed to follow the orders, whether they be for medications or treatments, according to how the physician has prescribed them. I mean, that's the basic bottom line in terms of facilities, is that, and there should be a lot of interaction, and there usually is, between the physician's office and the facility relative to when medications are changed, treatments are needed for one thing or another, and there should be that kind of good communication and interaction between the two.
What's the role of the pharmacist in that? That's a whole different discussion, because pharmacies, you know, there's different methods that pharmacies play in packaging pills and so on. But in my discussion with my pharmacist, who actually called the doctor because that my pharmacist was concerned there was a conflict in what was prescribed and what was being taken. And I know that pharmacists play a very important role. In fact, we're giving them, we're expanding their scope over time. What about pharmacies? Do you have any comments on that?
You know, Mr. Chair, I guess I would feel more comfortable someone who knows a lot more about the pharmacy rules and the role of the pharmacist. I do know that, you know, some facilities align themselves with a particular pharmacy, and that is to provide those consultative services that would assist them in overseeing the medications of particular residents. And maybe Jim can speak more to that. But definitely, the pharmacists do have a role. How big a role they have with respect to assisted living is something that probably the industry might know a little bit more of.
Senator Morris, yes. Following up on that, I think it's the public. My dad was because I'm a nurse, I was sort of on top of everything. But I think the public and the family doesn't realize the power that they can have if they get really involved in the care of their family member. For instance, they put my dad on a lactose-free diet. There was no reason to do that. And when in questioning that, the information given to the physician, he said, okay, etc. So I was being charged for a lactose-free diet when that wasn't it. The type of medication, they weren't giving them enough pain medication. And so I talked with the staff. They said, well, we don't have orders. So then I would call the physician. So there's a lot that the family really has to be up front. And yes, because they have orders, but unless the family is really on top of that, the patient is going to not be given the best care unless because they can't really speak for themselves. Really, they need a family member. Yes, an ombudsman is great, but they can't be there on a daily basis.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, that's absolutely correct. And, you know, some of the best care of residents happens when they have very involved family members. The unfortunate part about it is that there are a number of residents who don't have anyone who's involved in an ongoing way. The other part is that sometimes family members find themselves so emotionally invested that it is challenging for them to be an advocate for their resident because they get labeled by the facility as a complainer. They get labeled as, and that's mild, but they get labeled. And part of it is that in human communications, when you're so emotionally invested in the care of your loved one and you see something go wrong, it's very, very hard to objectively say, you know, one one, two, three. And so there are family members who become very wound up, and that communication becomes difficult. And the ombudsman serves a role there in coming in and sorting out the facts and trying to get what the resident needs. So that is something that we do a lot of in those situations. And then there are other things where family members are doing everything they should, but for some reason, until a third party like an ombudsman gets involved, there's no movement with respect to the issue. The paths of communication are not cleared. And so sometimes having that third party involvement gets people's attention in ways that they otherwise would not. And so that's very helpful. We look at ourselves as a resource for families. We like to, the ones that are actively involved, we want to empower them to continue. We want to provide them information so they can be the best advocates possible. And then those that can't or choose not to or simply are not available, we'd like to be there for those residents. And so that's the service, you know, that we try to provide. And again, most of the complaints that we work on, we try to resolve within the four walls of the facility to try to get that resident exactly to have their needs and their preferences met. And just rounding up, I should say, sort of the top complaints that we deal with. We deal with a lot of complaints from everything from housekeeping to equipment in the facility that's not in good repair, fire safety issues. A lot of those kinds of issues come to our attention. A lot of issues around basic care planning and assessment of resident, that there's that the care plan, and what the care plan is for a resident, it is sort of the core of how it's supposed to be a living document in which there's an evaluation of a resident, and then what the resident's needs are, what the resident's preferences are, what the services that the facility will be providing. All of that is supposed to be incorporated in this care or service plan, so it becomes sort of a living document and guides the facility in caring for the resident. And there's a lot of things that can go wrong in that process. Some of those plans are inadequate, so needs are not being addressed. Sometimes there's a very good care plan, but it's not being followed by the facility, or physician's orders are not followed. So we deal with a lot of issues around care plan, and we frequently served family members and residents will invite us to their care planning conference to work out issues, to ensure that issues related to their care are heard and that they become memorialized in the service plan. And then we also deal with a lot of issues around dignity and respect and staff attitudes about residents. Just treating people as human beings, respecting them, and that's an issue. Another big area that has emerged is our issues around gross neglect, and that is one of the sort of the top 10 areas that we've looked at in this area. And gross neglect probably would be differentiated from other kinds of neglect as being willful. And then the other big issue and is personal property being lost and stolen.
Could you give us a list of the top 10 at some point, get into the committee administrator?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. In just within a matter of just a week or so, we will be finalizing all of our data, and we can actually provide that across care settings as well. And so we will provide you with all of that data. Rounding out, but the facility that Mr. Chair referenced earlier in my presentation, we had lots of issues around theft. We had somewhere around 16 to 19 police reports. There was police involvement, and there was a huge amount of theft in the building going on. And so that becomes a big issue for residents and feeling some kind of security in this place that they call home. I looked at, I just wanted to just briefly look a little at some of what I took from some information that Mary provided me about some of the deficiencies that they cited. And I looked at sort of the citations by the inspectors of the that had looked at assisted living in 2008. And there were six different areas of citations that showed up in the top 10 citations in all four quarters of 2008. And I'll just briefly run down them. But they had to do with fire and life safety, change of condition, and monitoring. That's when a resident actually experiences some change in their health status and how the facility is able to pick up on that and evaluate it and monitor it and develop appropriate treatment plans around it. The next area that showed up were issues around medication and treatment orders, that they be carried out as prescribed. Another area was around staffing requirements and training. They also, among the deficiencies cited, were among the most frequent were just general service planning. The service plan reflects the residents' needs and preferences. And then the final area was resident health services, and that's how the facility must provide health services and have systems in place to respond to the 24-hour care needs of the residents. And so there seemed like there was some overlap in terms of some of the concerns that the regulatory is picking up in their inspection reports and what the ombudsmen are getting in the form of complaints as they relate to both medications and general service planning. So I think that there's probably more that we can do for you in terms of looking at this data that we have about issues that are emerging. And one of the pieces, again, that I don't have for you today is a look at some of the APS data, Adult Protective Services data, so you could see what kinds of issues are being substantiated in assisted living. And I'm sure that Mary can speak much more eloquently than I can about what deficiencies her surveyors, inspectors are seeing in facilities. But I guess I just close by saying that I do think that there is good care being provided out there in assisted living, but I also should say that I think that there's plenty of room for improvement in both quality of life and quality of care in these facilities.
Thank you so much. You did identify yourself at the beginning, but identify yourself one more time for the record, because we may not.
Meredith Cote, State Long-Term Care Ombudsman.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would the ombudsman, or maybe it should be DHS, transparency, I think, is going to be extremely important in this area, and especially since more and more of the baby boomers are going to be in these facilities. And would it be under your purview to, say, take a look at charges and for various services, as well as for service units, what each assisted living charges for their service units? I think we were up to $9 a service unit or $8 a service unit. But then what does, I know the charges are, but then I want to know, okay, what does Medicaid clients, what is the reimbursement rate, the actual reimbursement rate for, say, the baseline just rental, and then for the various care that they're given, so many points for not being able to feed themselves, so many points for not being able to dress themselves, all of that. Is there a broad look at that type of data?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moniz Anderson, I don't think that there is at this point in time. I think that the department representatives told you that they have pretty much stayed away from the finances relating to the private pay side and have pretty much made that a discussion between the facility and the residents within that facility. And then our agency is called upon when people have, one, they know to call us, and two, they're having concerns about their bills. But I don't think that there's ever been that kind of involvement that would look at sort of what I'm understanding you is to look at what facilities charge and have that, see if that, how that correlates to the Medicaid.
Well, what the hospitals did, because we were after them for some transparency, they now have a website, and each hospital then puts in the charges they're supposed to, not necessarily what they get reimbursed from the insurance companies, but for the public, that would help us tremendously on what we are getting into when we decide to put our loved one into a care facility.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, I agree with you. Anything that would help people in understanding. You know, one of the things about the rates in assisted living is that, you know, we used to call it sort of a la carte long-term care, because you'd come in and you'd pay a certain amount for your room and board, and then your services were on top of that. And facilities use different systems to allocate costs for the services that they provide. So there's some variation out there among the types of systems. And I know that when we start to work to unwind a complaint with respect to costs and billing, we have to get into whatever that system is in that particular facility. And, you know, sometimes, quite frankly, the people that are allocating, you know, you go into a service planning meeting, you have certain needs are identified, and then the services that attach to meeting those needs have some kind of price attached or points attached or whatever that results in a price, and that's that process is often unclear to people, and that's why, you know, in both the rules and in the residents' rights, you know, our agency has worked and advocated really hard to get more information out there about individual facility systems, so that the person involved in the system can at least have more information. You're taking it a step further, which would be systemically, I think it would be rather complex. But I absolutely think that families need all the resources they can.
Yeah, you did a really good job in 05, I think, on transparency, particularly with hospitals, and they did come out with some data that you can look at and compare and so on.
Could I just make one comment? You know, following the horrifying experiences of people in facilities during Katrina, Oregon passed laws that protect people in times of crisis. So not only are facilities supposed to have a plan for evacuation, but that they cannot leave the facility in time of crisis, and they must also have regular routine practices within that facility. So if you come across facilities not doing that, they actually are not in compliance with the law in Oregon today.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, I think that what you're saying is there has been clearly a renewed emphasis on emergency preparedness and emergency planning, and I know the department now has a staff person who's dedicated to working with facilities to develop those kinds of plans. What I would say to you is it's still very much a work in progress, and that many of the facilities are working in their communities to try to identify and link resources, and it is an ongoing process. I think communities throughout Oregon are still working to develop their plans. They've gotten funding to help them, but they're still in the process of their developing their plans, and so many facilities have to link into those community plans, because in times of crisis, resources have to be coordinated and shared, and that's the one thing that we're still working on here in Oregon.
I can understand that. I just want to be sure that facilities, however, regardless of the plan that's going to be very complicated, that they understand that they have to have an emergency plan of exiting people, and also that the staff themselves cannot leave. And that would be really terrible. But in closing, I'd just like to say you not only are a resource for families and so forth, but you are a godsend to legislators, because if it were not for the work that you do, that time of questions and following up would be staff time within our own offices. So I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for that.
Thank you, Senator.
That's in lieu of a pay raise. Just so you know how much you appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, I think you should just stem the tide of the downward spiral.
Oh, just keep it the way it is. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jim and Ruth, please come up. And Jim, if you don't finish, I see your big, thick packet you're going to give us. We will call you back. We can carry over some information and or some of your Mr. Vice Chair,
yes, sir.
Seems to me that we are able to carry over from one hearing to another without reposting. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So we do have an agenda posted for Thursday, but
Wednesday.
I'm sorry, but I didn't mean to cut you off so soon.
Yeah.
You know, we got 15 minutes.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you can do that. And just one minor point that seemed interesting to me: that the system might benefit from a really good prescription drug monitoring program as well.
Yeah,
so I just thought I'd throw that out there. So
good. Welcome. You want to go ahead and introduce? Why don't you all three of you introduce yourself first, and then we can go from there.
Jim Carlson here today representing the Oregon Healthcare Association.
Okay.
Ruth Gullius representing the Oregon Alliance of Senior and Health Services.
Okay, Ruth.
Mauro Hernandez, I'm with Concepts in Community Living.
Okay, thank you. We covered a lot today so far, and you're the necessary other piece to this discussion. And so we look forward to working together to deal with some of the changing demographics and changing conditions and so on and so forth. So please go ahead.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you've heard a lot of information, and I'm not going to really work off my handout in any great detail. You asked for kind of a 30,000-foot overview, and I think you've gotten a very good overview. I think what I'd like to say is this will be my 22nd year lobbying in the building in the healthcare, health policy arena. First 8 years in acute care, last 14 in long-term care. And I think what you've heard a little bit about today is a description of what a complex bundle of services you're dealing with when you're providing long-term care services to an individual. In the acute care world, you know, generally speaking, you're dealing with episodic care and situation. You go to that physician office visit. You go to that short hospital stay, which in Oregon I think is average 2.1 days. Very short episodic care. When you enter into the long-term care system, you're dealing not only with coordination of health care services for people with very complex health care needs and chronic health conditions. You're dealing with social services and support. You're dealing with housing and issues like food and a lot of things that really get to how people live and where they live, in addition to just the services that they need to receive. So I think you've gotten a real good sense of that. The other thing that's dramatically different from the acute care world is the oversight and monitoring in the long-term care arena is much more extensive than what you're going to find in the acute care world. You've got the licensing agency, you've got the regularly scheduled on-site inspections, the surveys, you've got complaint surveys that are generated in cases of consumer complaints, where you've got dedicated state-trained staff surveyors who will come out and do that. You've got the adult protective services piece, and then you also have the excellent work that's done done by volunteer ombudsmen in the state to really be a resource for residents of long-term care and family members for long-term care. You also have, Senator Mona Sanderson mentioned transparency, you also have virtually all that information is public record, and an awful lot of it's available on the internet to people. Survey deficiencies, complaints, all this information is public record, and it's out there, and it is very transparent. I think the discussion around what family members need to do to be actively involved is absolutely key. Quarterly care planning conferences, these kinds of things, which is obviously an ideal situation for individuals who have family members there who can be involved. Many providers are working very hard now to use technology and other things to even bring family members in from remote locations so they can participate from a remote location into that care planning process. But it's a very complicated bundle of services, I think, as you're well aware, and a whole lot of different areas we could focus on today, many of which have already been touched upon. And so I'm not going to spend any more time on prepared remarks, rather let some other folks talk and then be prepared to respond to questions.
One of the concerns that came up was the difficulty and lack of commonality in the way billings are made to facilities and so on. Do you see any? What's your?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I mean, obviously, it can get very complex, but to break it down and look at it from a little bit different perspective. In almost all situations, you're going to have a room and board component, okay, for that housing component that's a base rate. And that's going to vary a little bit based upon whether it's a studio apartment, whether it's a one-bedroom, a two-bedroom. So you've got some different things there on the housing component. The service component is where the complexity gets. You can run all the way into folks who have very high care needs on end-stage dementia in an Alzheimer's care unit, a special endorsed Alzheimer's care unit, to you can go to folks who have very light care or light service needs who are living quite independently, and then you've got everything that runs in between. I think your biggest challenge that you see there, and I think Meredith Cody was correct when she said it gets very complex, in that different providers are going to use different systems to do their assessments and convert those assessments into units of service, to convert those into price points, if you will, in the marketplace. And you also have different communities that are maybe targeted to different sectors of the marketplace as well. And so I think it gets very challenging there. I think I can say unequivocally that all providers have to disclose this information up front and disclose this on an ongoing basis and deal with their residents and with their family members and with their customers, if you will. And if you're working with a provider who's not doing a good job of explaining that, who's not taking the time to sit down and go through that with you, that should be a concern. On the front end, and these are good discussions that need to be had up front with required consumer disclosures and the like prior to admission. Once somebody's been admitted and you're dealing with this, it's very important to try to participate as a family member in those quarterly care conferences and that service planning.
Well, I guess the concern was that there's okay, let me ask it a different way. Are you aware of any states that require some commonality in from the various facilities that provide services in that state for a simpler way of explaining what they are? I mean, that, or is it...
Mr. Chair, if the question is, am I aware of anyone who's got a uniform payment system for the private pay? No, I'm not.
Okay.
And
well, would you please check with your... Well, okay, what I'm asking you to do is if you would think about that, and if there is a solution or if there is a common reporting, if each facility was given a form that they could translate what they're trying to say into that form, to make it better understandable in common, that would be good for comparisons. If you're going to shop around for a facility to go to, it would help if there was some commonality in the billing process.
Sure.
And the language.
Mr. Chair, members of committee, for the most part, I don't think providers are at all reluctant to be transparent with what their rates are. I think it's a question of when you get into folks who have greater service needs and some of the complexities. And Morrow may be a good person here on the panel to, if you want him to talk a little bit about how they do their assessments, their care planning, how they convert that into a rate structure. He certainly has got a lot of direct hands-on experience with that process.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Who wants to go first, Ruth or Mauro?
I just wanted to give you a quick overview. After learning of the hearing, I represent not-for-profit mission directors, providers of quality housing and services. And in order to give you sort of an overview of what's going on in the state, I posed five questions to my members on Friday, and many of them got back with me. And I just wanted to share with you really quickly sort of their view of the world and the economic backdrop and what the $260 did for them. I asked them, how is the current downturn in the economy affecting your program residents and staff? What are you doing to address the situation? What trend are you seeing in your overall Medicaid census, and what did the $260 do for you, as well as what they wanted me to say to you? So I'll just briefly summarize. What folks are feeling is varied, of course, in terms of the economic backdrop. Some are seeing that with the residents who have lost significant savings. They're inquiring more about financial hardships because some of the folks provide financial scholarships for residents. They're working with them individually. Some aren't seeing an impact yet at all, though they're expecting it. Staff. I didn't particularly ask about staff, but that came up in the course of answering the questions. What we're seeing in terms of workforce, and I don't think this is a surprise in down times, staff are hanging on to their jobs longer. And we also, comment I had was it's easier to find staff, and the quality of the folks stepping forward is higher than what we've seen. And staff are holding on to their jobs longer. What folks are doing to address the situation, like all of us, carefully monitoring expenses, constantly reassuring staff who are very concerned about their own continued employment, conservatively budgeting, holding the line on everything, limiting capital expenditures, preserving cash as much as possible. Another provider said, we're tightening up on spending, being increasingly careful about the extra charges incurred to residents and doing the best to be good standards of their dollars as well as our own. Trend that folks are seeing in overall census. Several have said they've seen their Medicaid census rising rapidly. There doesn't seem to be the same amount of private pay out there. Some have seen it remain the same. In one area, one of my providers said they've seen Medicaid increasingly go up, and that is because they're the only one in the area that's still taking Medicaid. $260 per month allowed them to increase their level of Medicaid, as well as take a wider range of Medicaid tenants. It's allowed them to financially stabilize facilities, particularly in rural communities. It's helped reduce losses associated with taking Medicaid. Another member said it's helped significantly, but we still lose on taking Medicaid. We just don't lose as much. And another one said, instead of losing on each Medicaid resident, we break even. So this really gets to the difference in private pay and in Medicaid. Message that they wanted me to deliver to you is particularly in rural communities, folks depend on Medicaid and the level of reimbursement, which is really critical to keeping seniors and jobs in the rural communities. Funding reductions would have a drastic impact on the availability of care options and jobs and negatively impact the tax base in an area that already has a long history of negative economic hardships. We need to be careful about increasing regulations and look at how reimbursement is provided so that providers can continue to serve high-need clients. In closing, I just wanted to share, we talked about the difference between changing the income eligibility for Medicaid and what that would do if we went to the 200%. So I just wanted to give you a picture of what that means for assisted living. And when you look at DHS caseloads as of September 2008, there's 4,300 that would lose, if we changed the Medicaid eligibility, lose services under Medicaid. A good 24% of those reside in assisted living. And with those in assisted living, 30% are at very high level needs, meaning they're at they've been assessed. They're at level what we call service priority level 3, meaning that they've been assessed to be dependent in mobility, cognition, or eating. So these are high a good percentage of very high-need people being served in Medicaid and assisted living. I want to let Dr. Hernandez speak, because he's also, not only does he operate several assisted livings in the state of Oregon, he's also a very respected researcher and has done his doctoral thesis on long-term care, including assisted living.
You represent the nonprofit assisted living. Would you take a look at the governor's recommended budget and recommended cuts if you haven't already? And would you, when you come back, which we will ask you to come back, give us some input concerning how it may impact your facilities?
Chair Morissette, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Morissette, and other members of the committee for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Mauro Hernandez, and I'm with Concepts in Community Living. We're a small management and development consulting firm in Clackamas, and we've been, since 1988, helping others develop or operate affordable supportive housing options. Back in 88, we were actually partnering with the state to develop the pilot program that served the first Medicaid-funded assisted living resident. Today, six of the licensed communities we manage in the state of Oregon are in Portland, St. Helens, Grants Pass, Myrtle Creek, and Hines and Maupin. Four of these are owned by nonprofit organizations, and in Oregon, we now employ 143 employees and serve 245 residents, almost half of which depend on Medicaid as their primary source of payment. And for the next few minutes, I'm actually going to cut back my remarks and focus on the issue of Medicaid rather than the state of the industry, which we've been already hearing about, which is fairly, probably more stable than headlines would lead you to believe it from our perspective. Medicaid has definitely played a major role in the viabilities of our communities, and that's partly because we've tended to target rural and other more difficult to serve populations. A few years ago, I did conduct a study at the University of California that looked at Oregon's long-term care system over the last two decades. And one of the major findings was that in this state, assisted living has been more accessible to Medicaid residents and people in rural communities than in the rest of the country, where assisted living nationally only about 9% of Medicaid residents, 9% of the resident population is Medicaid. In Oregon, it's been traditionally much higher, and that's largely because Medicaid is the key that can open the door to assisted living for older and disabled adults with fewer resources. But I do have to say that much has changed since I completed the study. Today, coming back to Oregon a couple of years ago, I'm very concerned about the steady gradual erosion that you've been hearing about in terms of the Medicaid payment levels during the last few years. The gap between private pay and public prices has continued to widen, as you've heard, with two notable consequences. First, you've been hearing about the unprecedented around the country of number of facilities pulling out of the Medicaid program or choosing not to join the Medicaid program. This compares to the 1990s when almost every assisted living provider viewed Medicaid contracting as a sound business decision. The simple economics will tell you is the private pay, as the price for private pay assisted living goes up, and the price for a public pay assisted living stays too much lower, and the gap widens, the supply of affordable assisted living beds is going to shrink or not grow in step with the population. The second consequence that you've been hearing about a little bit about is the way that the gap is being borne by private pay residents. For many of our communities, withdrawing from the Medicaid program just isn't an option. I mentioned the Aspens, our community in Hines, which is owned by a small local nonprofit. Since Burns and Hines no longer have a nursing home, there's no other facility that could serve those residents, except perhaps a smaller residential care facility in town. But they're full and have a waiting list. But in order to break even in the coming year, and slowly build its reserve, this community plans to increase its private pay rates by 8% rather than the usual 5%, partly because Medicaid rates are so far below where they should be. The same goes for our community in Myrtle Creek. whose private pay rates are scheduled to increase by 9% later this year. Between January and November, I'll point out that that facility lost over $80,000, which is clearly unsustainable. I can touch on the question of rate disclosure, and I agree that this has been an issue since for 10 years or so, I think, when this first came up, even at the federal level with the General Accounting Office concerned about pricing and assisted living. And one of the things that came out of that and the practice that Oregon adopted, like a lot of other states, has been to adopt consumer disclosure requirements. So we looked at procedures being used in other states to create a uniform disclosure form that is now required or has been required since mm-hmm. the late 1999, I think. Mm-hmm. It might have been revised, but the practice in other states that I've looked at has not necessarily been to mandate a uniform way of charging for services, but a uniformity in disclosing to consumers at the beginning how they charge for services, because the thing we realized in talking with Meredith at that time was that there was a real mismatch in expectations and lack of information and a lack of understanding about and clarity and transparency. So at that time we were fully on board with improving and doing what we could to better disclose what we share with consumers. Because we felt that that would mitigate complaints and misunderstandings later. Now, to say that we do a perfect job in it, probably not, but I'm sorry.
Do you see room for improvement?
Senator Moore said, I would love to know more about some of the problems. We haven't had a lot of complaints in our buildings.
Okay.
As far as I know, we haven't had ombudsman investigations in terms of our disclosure procedures. I'm certainly open to learning more about some of the problems.
Well, one of the interesting things that happened with the hospitals as a result of the effort for transparency was a publication and a website, I believe, mm-hmm. that I could look at in my community, McKinsey Willamette Hospital, which is now a private facility, and Peace Health, which is nonprofit, and compare procedures and so on and so forth. And there, I guess that kind of transparency. Now, I'm not sure what kind of information is on the internet. There are different programs that have been created recently to help people shop for assisted living, but I don't know the detail that it gets into in terms of what we're talking about.
Senator Worth, I do know, I mean, I don't know of any state required price disclosure websites. I mean, I think the one that comes closest maybe is New Jersey. New Jersey, I believe, does have a way for consumers to go onto the internet and see what the facility citation history is and possibly charges, but I'm not 100% sure.
They license services, not facilities in New Jersey, so it's a little bit of a tough comparison. You have information on the internet right now that shows the range of pricing.
Does it list, Mr. Chair?
The problem you're going to have is, unlike in a hospital type of billing where it's procedure-coded, okay, we're not procedure-coded. What you're going to have is you're going to have a variation on how people price the housing, the room and board components, and that's all pretty plain vanilla on the pricing. And then you're going to have, you know, how folks do their service assessment and convert that into their billed charges. Now, some folks use very sophisticated computerized software programs based on time allocations. Other folks use a very simple, just a couple of different service rates, a couple different levels. And so I think you can disclose ranges. I think the problem is until you have an individual and you determine in that particular facility their service needs, what that charge is going to be. And that's where I think, as Morrow indicated, our emphasis has always been on the consumer disclosure piece and requirements for consumer disclosure.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think I'm looking more for something even more basic in just having one website that lists every assisted living. I don't know if we could get all foster care homes there, but residential, because I have people calling me since they know that, you know, my mother was in an adult foster care home, my dad was in assisted living. they say, where should we go? Where can we go? You know, and so that's what I'm looking for. One website that just sort of lists the availability. You know, some people want to know by location in particular.
Yeah. Network of Care, do they do that?
Well, I'd say, Mr. Chair, Sarah Moniz Anderson, right now you've got literally dozens and dozens of websites that will list all the licensed facilities in the state. Our website lists all the licensed facilities in the state, and you can do searches by geographic, by type of services and the like. The issue is we could put onto a state website, we could put that up and we could say a range on pricing, but it's not going to tell you specific.
No.
It's going to say, you know, average rate structure $2,200 to $5,800 a month. You're going to see a pretty big range because so much of the pricing is based upon service need.
Well, that's, I think, every legislator should have their staff member know that website mm-hmm. to go to. I'm serious mm-hmm. because I wasn't aware of that.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Moniz Anderson, through the SPD DHS website, I believe they are linked to a website called Network of Care.
Yeah.
A lot of the aging services networks use that particular one. Some of you might recall Jacqueline Zimmer, who used to work in the building. She actually works for the company that manages
yeah.
that particular
mm-hmm.
site.
In fact, I think we invested some
but there was
money
nothing listed
that.
In my area, see, so it wasn't comprehensive at all.
Really?
It's building itself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry that we're running out of time, but I really appreciate all of you being here, and I'm impressed with the range of your facilities from Portland, St. Helens, Grants Pass, Myrtle Creek, Hines, Maupin. I mean, that's great.
Thinking more rural.
Well, and you may be, or one of the things that, you know, Senator Cruz and I have been involved in for a long time, rural Oregon healthcare, and I know that when facilities close in a small rural community, people, it's a real, real hardship for people to travel to see their loved ones. Also, it's an employment base. It's an economic development thing, and so I think we have to particularly pay attention to keeping facilities open if we possibly can. So I ask you again to look at the governor's proposed budget, which will be changed, I'm sure, but it needs to be examined carefully, and we need to have some feedback concerning the hardship that it will cause for the most needy people in the state of Oregon. So we will invite you back, and thank you very,
thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you want to adjourn?
No, I don't want to adjourn. But I will anyway. We are adjourned.